So New Year's is a pretty cool day, I think. There's just kind of an energy in the air around New Year's. You know, Christmas is past, and now we have this feeling of more anticipation as the new year is coming, and we just kind of feel excited, and there's this hopefulness, and I don't know, it's just kind of a cool time of year, I think. How many of you are actually going to be awake at midnight tonight? I'm going to take my hand down. How many of you are going to be in bed at 10 o'clock and hoping the neighbors don't, fireworks don't wake up your kids? Yeah. Yeah, let's be real. There's a lot of ways to ring in the new year. You know, the comfort of your bed, that's fine. There's people in New York where it's like minus 1,000 degrees. If that's what they want to do, that's fine. But I remember one time when I was a kid ringing in the new year. It was 1987, and we're ringing in 1988, so exactly 30 years ago. And I'm this little girl, 6 years old, standing on our front porch with my sisters. In one hand, we had pots and pans. And in the other hand, we had wooden spoons. And at the stroke of midnight, we began this gosh-awful noise, banging the pots and pans, screaming, and making this horrible noise that I really don't know why the neighbors didn't call the police. It was awful. It was terrible. And the 80s were weird, y'all. I mean, really. Apparently, this was a thing. I don't know. Maybe this was what we did before fireworks were so easy to get. Not sure if it wasn't a thing. I don't really know what to tell you. Assume what you will about my family. I don't know. But I remember standing on the front porch, making this noise, and at some point, my older sister said, "Goodbye, 1987." And I must have said something like, "See you next time." And my sister stopped, and she looked at me, and I looked at her like, "What?" And she said, "No, there's not going to be another 1987. And I'm like, "Ha, what?" And she said, "No, that was it. It's gone. No more." And I'm looking at her like she's crazy, and she's looking at me like I'm crazy. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, hold on. Because this is the kind of joke that an older brother or sister would play, you know? My whole world has just come crashing down, and I'm thinking, is she serious? Is she messing with me? I don't know. And I don't know what I thought, if it was like the days and the months that, you know, eventually it'll be December again, eventually it'll be Tuesday again, that kind of thing. I don't know if that's what I thought, but I was completely shocked, and completely shocked. And, you know, we laugh about it now, but I think there's a lot of us in the room today who are saying, thank goodness there will never be another 2017. I think there's a lot of us in the room who feel that way. See, I see your posts on Facebook. Some of you, since September, October, have been talking about the new year. You're saying, I am so ready to be done with this year and move on. I see those posts. I see the calendars that are out front and center in October in the stores. We're waiting for people to be excited about the new year, to get their new calendars, to take that old, wrinkly, scribbled up one down off the wall and hang up this bright, shiny, clear new one. Because we want the new start. We want that fresh beginning. We have these great expectations for a new year. It feels so hopeful. We want to be able to move past the things that have disappointed us and that have held us back, the things that we feel stuck in. And I just want to invite you now to come back to our next series that's going to be starting next week called Unstuck. We're going to be talking very practically about those things that leave us feeling stuck in life, and we're going to talk about how we can move past those in the new year. So that'll start next week, and I hope you'll come back for that. But how many of you have a New Year's resolution? Not too many. How many of you are deciding whether or not you actually want to do a New Year's resolution? Yeah, that's more like it. And see, New Year's resolutions come from what we're talking about, this feeling of, I don't like what I saw back there, and I want what's coming ahead to be better. That's what they are. And I'm kind of a word nerd. Y'all might know that about me. So I looked up the word resolution, not necessarily for this. I was just curious because that's what word nerds do. And I looked up the word resolution, and it said that a resolution is a firm determination to do or not do something. And I thought, yeah, that sounds about right. Because we go into the new year saying, I am going to do this. I'm going to exercise more. I'm going to eat better. I'm going to be better with money. I'm going to spend more time with my family. And I am not going to eat cake every night. I am not going to do this. I am not going to do this. Because we see things that didn't work so well in the past, and we want to change it going into the future. We're ready to put all of that behind us, and we have these new great expectations for our families, for our homes, for our jobs, for our finances, for our relationships, for our health, for everything, all the things, because we want next year to be better. We want next year to be different. 2018 will be different. We resolve ourselves. We have this firm determination that it will be different. But I think the problem is that some of us are kind of faking that hope. I think the problem is that we've all been burned by those great expectations at one point or another. We've all felt that feeling of disappointment or being blindsided for something that we're not prepared for. We've all had that guilty feeling when we realize, I said I was going to do that, and I haven't done any of that. Haven't even thought about it since. Last year, I had a word of the year. This is kind of a trend. You can look for it on Instagram and stuff, hashtag one word. And it's basically the idea that instead of making resolutions, you choose one word, or sometimes the word chooses you, that you're going to focus on, that you're going to really be intentional and study that word and center your life around that word. And I was ready for it. Last year, my word was renewal, and I thought, this is going to be amazing. And so I had planned to do my own personal Bible studies and do these things all around the word renewal, and I was set. I was so excited about this word. And then in April, I forgot the word. Between January 1st and April, not only lost track of what I was supposed to be doing, but I actually forgot the word. I was so far off track that I forgot even what I was supposed to be doing. And so much for that idea. And I think a lot of us have resolutions that are that way. Around April or May, we find that gym membership card in our wallet and go, oh yeah, that's right. We remember these things that we said that we were going to do, and all of a sudden we realize, I didn't do that. I didn't break that habit that I said I was going to break. I didn't start that new habit that I said I was going to start. And really nothing has changed since January. And oh my goodness, now it's December 31st and I'm supposed to make another resolution. And can I really make the same resolution for the 10th year in a row? We've all been there. We get it. Because we lug these resolutions from one year to the next year to the next year. I think we all get that. But sometimes it's not even about resolutions. This kind of dread or not feeling quite right about the new year. Because sometimes what we're lugging into the new year is not an unresolved resolution. Sometimes it's a situation that no resolution in the world can help. Sometimes it's a situation that we cannot grit our teeth and have firm determination and fix. Sometimes that's what we're facing the new year with, and we're carrying that and we say, I want to have hope. I want to have great expectations, but it doesn't look so good. What do I do with that? And so I think a lot of times we end up, instead of having this hope, we're kind of scared. We're scared to anticipate. We're scared to be excited. We're scared to have that hope because we've been disappointed before. And so having those hopes, making those resolutions, dreaming of better things for the new year can feel like setting ourselves up for disappointment. And we think, why bother? It's always been the same. It's always going to be the same. Nothing's ever going to change. But what if I told you that there's one thing that you could do right now, today, that would change your new year? That would make 2018 different from all the other years. If I told you that, you'd probably be skeptical, but maybe you'd be interested too. I know I was when I started working on this message and I started thinking about all of this. God led me to the book of Joshua. This is not what I thought I was going to be speaking on today, and it's probably not what you were expecting to hear from today. And if you're not familiar with the book of Joshua or the Old Testament, don't worry. We're so glad that you're here as you're exploring this. We're all going into the new year, so this applies to everybody. And I'm going to recap the story because, let's face it, we all forget these things. So the backstory of the book of Joshua. God's chosen people had been wandering in the desert for 40 years. He freed them from slavery in Egypt. They started whining, griping. They didn't trust him, basically became the worst travel companions ever. And so he said, you guys just need to wander around a bit and learn a few lessons. So they wandered for 40 years in the desert. And Moses, their leader, didn't actually make it into the promised land, the land that they were working toward and moving toward the whole time. A man named Joshua took over at that point. And Joshua led them into this promised land, the land that God had said would belong to his people. It'd be flowing with milk and honey and all the good things they could ever dream of. It's the land where they would see the promises of God fulfilled. Joshua led them in, and as soon as they were in, they saw the city, Jericho. It's a walled city, fortified with these huge walls. And under God's instructions, the people of Israel managed to take the city by doing some pretty strange things. They marched, all 2 million of them, around the city every day for 6 days. On the seventh day, they marched around 7 times, blew trumpets, shouted, and the walls came a-tumbling down, as the song goes. This is a great story. We love stories like this because we can't really picture this in our mind. Like, how did that work? And we love pictures in our minds of God doing these crazy things because we want that for our lives. So we tell stories like this over and over and over again. But the story we don't tell is what happened right before this. Right before they took down that wall by shouting and screaming. We don't talk about that, and that's where I want us to focus today. This is in Joshua chapter 3. And at this point, the Israelites have not made it into the promised land. They're still in the desert. They're still wandering. But they know that they're getting close. They can kind of see that the vegetation, the plants and everything are getting different. And they know that the river is there. And they know that when they cross that river, they'll be in. And so I think in the camp, there were probably a lot of mixed emotions, like there are mixed emotions in here today. Some people were probably excited. We're finally there. All of this is done, and we can finally just go in and forget about it. Some people were probably apprehensive, not knowing what was coming, scared to be excited, scared to have hope. And some people probably just weren't sure that they wanted to go in for the simple reason that it meant change. And I think we can all relate to some of those things. But their leader, Joshua, comes to them at this point with all these mixed emotions and all of this that's going on, and he has something to say to them from God. This is in Joshua chapter 3. He says, Joshua told the people, consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do amazing things among you. Come here and listen to the words of the Lord your God. This is how you will know that the living God is among you, and that he will certainly drive out before you the Canaanites, Hittites, Hivites, Perizzites, Girgashites, Amorites, and Jebusites. Now, those are a whole bunch of weird groups of people, and thankfully that is not important here. God has a message for the Israelites that simply, he is going to do something to prove that he's in control, so that when they get to all of these weird groups of people, they'll know he's in control. He's going to do one thing to prove himself again, so that they'll know when they get further down the road. So here's what he says. See, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of all the earth will go into the Jordan ahead of you. Now, the Ark of the Covenant was the very presence of God that dwelled among the Israelites. So the presence of the Lord will go into the Jordan ahead of you. And as soon as the priests who carry the Ark of the Lord of all the earth, set foot in the Jordan, its waters flowing downstream will be cut off and stand up in a heap. Now, before I go on, I just have to say, have you ever referred to water in a heap? It's weird. It's really weird. A heap of water. Not what we normally say. But look at what God is saying. He's promising to do this one thing so that they will know that he is in control. What's the promise? He's going to stop the flowing of the river. And I think the Israelites were probably thinking, well, that sounds kind of crazy. But I've heard the stories. They've been fed by manna all this time, food that just fell from the sky. They've heard the stories of how God got them out of Egypt. So maybe they're thinking, okay, yeah, he can stop a river. He can do that. And so I think maybe they're getting a little excited, daring to hope, daring to think that this might be about to happen. They are so close, they can almost taste it. And so I think the mood in the camp is changing. So they start moving, all 2 million of them, toward the river. And as they get closer, they make something of a surprising discovery. This is what they find. Now, the Jordan is at flood stage all during harvest. This is a line in scripture that you'd probably just skip right over. But it grabbed my attention this week because I'm thinking the Israelites could not have expected this. They weren't from the area. So when God said, I'm going to stop the river, they weren't thinking, oh, well, that's going to be a pretty big feat because the river's at flood stage during harvest. They didn't know that. They were probably thinking he's going to stop this small river or a creek. It's something of a stream. Okay, go God, we're going to be able to make it through. But then they come to this raging, roaring river that has burst past its banks. I did some research. The River Jordan, when it is at flood stage, is 150 feet deep. It's a mile wide, and the waters move at least 10 miles an hour. So I'm picturing 2 million people. Estimates are like 600,000 families, so 600,000 men, women, children, all coming together, standing on the edge of this river, and they're looking and thinking, God said he was going to stop the river, but I don't think this is what he meant, because this is not what we expected. This is not just a river. This is crazy. I've seen pictures of flooded rivers. They're standing in front of this. And now, y'all know what it's like to travel with just your family. And they're standing with 600,000 other families, all the kids, all the pets, all the stuff, and they have to get it across this river. And I think at this point they're thinking, I don't know, God. It'd be pretty cool if you did, but I'm not sure. I think at this point they're thinking, this is a setup. This isn't going to work. This is not what we expected. This isn't what we envisioned. But when we think things are a setup, that's a chance for God to show up. And God does hear what only he can do. He comes, and he fulfills his promise. See, watch. Yet as soon as the priest who carried the ark reached the Jordan and their feet touched the water's edge, the water from upstream stopped flowing. It piled up in a heap a great distance away at a town called Adam in the vicinity of Zarethan, while the water flowing down to the Sea of the Arabah, that is the Dead Sea, was completely cut off. So the people crossed over opposite Jericho. The priests who carried the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord stopped in the middle of the Jordan and stood on dry ground, while all Israel passed by until the whole nation had completed the crossing on dry ground. So the Israelites faced this impossible obstacle. Seems like a setup. This isn't going to work. And then God shows up. Because notice one thing. They cross on dry ground. Moments before, this had been a flooded river, raging waters, and now it's dry. It doesn't say that they completed the crossing on mud, on marshy ground, that they sludged through it. They completed the crossing on dry ground. They face this obstacle. God shows up, and he does what only he can do. God does what he does. He shows them, I am God. He made a way where there was no way. He made it happen. He did what only he could do so that his people could do what no one else ever had. They managed to cross into the promised land. They'd heard about it. They dreamed about it. And now they were there, finally, in the promised land. And they're ready to move on, move in, take this thing. Because God's told them, the cities will fall. The people will come under your control. The ones that you don't kill. You've got this. This land is yours. I will make sure of it. He's promised it. So they're ready to move forward. They're ready to do what they have to do. They're ready to make this their home, forget about all that other stuff, move on. They're ready. Except God knows that they're not. There's one more thing that he needs for them to do. One more thing before they can move on. Joshua chapter 4 says this. When the whole nation had finished crossing the Jordan, the Lord said to Joshua, choose 12 men from among the people, one from each tribe, and tell them to take up 12 stones from the middle of the Jordan, from right where the priests are standing, and carry them over with you and put them down at the place where you stay tonight. So the people went up from the Jordan and camped at Gilgal on the eastern border of Jericho. And Joshua set up at Gilgal the 12 stones they had taken out of the Jordan. He said to the Israelites, "In the future, when your descendants ask their parents, 'What do these stones mean?' tell them, 'Israel crossed the Jordan on dry ground. For the Lord your God dried up the Jordan before you until you had crossed over. The Lord your God did to the Jordan what he had done to the Red Sea when he dried it up before us until we'd crossed over. He did this so that all the peoples of the earth might know that the hand of the Lord is powerful, and so that you might always fear the Lord your God.'" So God has some instructions for them. Find 12 stones. Seems kind of strange. He says, put 12 stones together for the single purpose of remembering. God is creating a tradition of remembrance. He doesn't say, stop, remember, and then move on. He says, no, I want you to remember this, and remember this, and remember this. Don't lose sight of this. Remember this. Before they could move forward, they had to stop. Before they could move forward, they had to pause and look back. God said, you're not ready yet until you pause and you look back. Because he had something that they needed to do. It wasn't resolutions. It wasn't making plans. It wasn't sketching out a detailed map of how they were going to make this work. It had nothing to do with that. God only wanted them to remember. Before they could move into the promises, before they could grasp the destiny that he had for them, he told them to stop. Remember. Remember what God's done. Remember who did this. And he initiates this culture, this tradition of remembrance. He's saying it's not just today, it's in the future. I want you to remember this. And once they had done that, then they were given the go-ahead to move into the land. See, God wanted to make sure that they stopped to remember what had really happened. To stop and say, wait a minute. There was a flooded river. And God stopped that. He said he would, and he did. God did that. He wanted them to stop and marvel at that. He needed them to remember that. Because just like God had known that the river was flooded before the Israelites knew, God knew that there were obstacles right ahead of them. He knew there was a huge city with huge walls. He knew there were sentries that were waiting to kill them. He knew that there were violent cultures that they were going and they were supposed to enter into and do away with. He knew all of these obstacles, all of these things that they would be facing. But they didn't know. He knew that the struggles were coming. He knew that their expectations of things being easy were not going to happen. God knew. And he knew that they weren't ready until they remembered. He knew they were not ready to go ahead until they looked back at the path that they'd already traveled and seen him there. Because again, God knew what they didn't. And that is that focusing on the faithfulness of God leaves no room for fear of the future. When we focus on the faithfulness of God, we cannot be afraid of the future. See, if the people had walked up to the fortified walls of Jericho and seen this, I am confident that they would have been fearful. They would have been scared. They would have thought, how in the world is this going to happen? But they had just stopped. They had just spent time remembering the amazing things that God does. They had just remembered that God said he would stop the river, and he stopped the river. But I think if they hadn't done that, they would have approached the walls scared, apprehensive. They might have been a little bit arrogant. They might have made their own plans, made things a lot more complicated than they had to be, might have endangered themselves needlessly. They might not have trusted God at all to do what he said he would do, but they had just stopped. And they had just remembered. They had remembered his faithfulness. because it's important for us to stop. God knows that we have a pretty severe case of spiritual amnesia. That when he does something, we praise him and we may say, God, you did that. We may not. We may not even acknowledge that he did it. But if we do, we say, God, you are amazing. I can't believe you did that. That is amazing. And then we move on. And the next unpredictable situation comes, the next thing comes that we're not prepared for, and we start worrying all over again. And so God says, no, you need to stop. You need to remember. Because when you remember my faithfulness, then you can go ahead without fear. God knew what they needed to do. And I think it's the same thing that we need to do today, facing a new year. They were crossing the river into a promised land. We're flipping the page of a calendar into a new year, but it's the same situation. God asks us to stop and then go. We have to stop before we can go. Because God doesn't just want our resolutions. Resolutions are good. There's nothing wrong with that because there are habits we need to break. There are things we need to improve on. There are things that we need to start doing. That is true. But we shouldn't plunge forward bullheaded into the new year until we have stopped. Because God doesn't want our resolutions. He wants our remembrance. He wants us to remember that he was there. Some of us already know that our year is going to be hard. Our calendars are already marked up with doctor's appointments, meetings we don't want to go to, things we've been dreading for months already. They're getting closer, and we know it's going to be a hard year. We're staring it down, and we know some of us are looking into the new year assuming it's not going to change. We look around us and think, here comes more of the same. Some of us are dragging those situations from one year to the next, thinking, well, it's still going to be there, so can anything ever really be different? And we have little hope for our future because of what we see in the past. And I think some of us in our culture, we're just anxious. We're just nervous. Because the truth is, we don't know what's going to happen next year. And we think some of it will be good, but a lot of it's going to be bad. And a lot of it's going to be hard. And I don't know how to prepare for something if I don't know what it is. And so we get scared. We get really nervous. We start to dread it. But I don't think it has to be that way. I don't think we have to go into the future with dread. Because no, we don't know what's going to happen next year, next month, tomorrow, this afternoon. We don't know. But we don't have to fear, because think about it. We make our resolutions based on disappointments, failures, flaws in our past, ways that we've been let down. But what if we go into the future not looking at that, but looking at God? What if we go into the future putting our great expectations not on our own failures, not basing it on what we've done wrong, on the things that have been bad, on the bad experiences and the disappointments? What if we don't focus on that, but focus instead on God's faithfulness? I think if we focus on his faithfulness going into the new year, then we can go in with hope. We can go in with hope and not fear. We can go in with greater expectations than if we knew everything was going to go our way. Because God does things we can't even imagine. See, our great expectations, if we can even muster them, come when we look at how we have failed. How life sometimes has failed us. But greater expectations come when we look at how God never has. This time last year, I was rejoicing in what God had done in my life. I had just come out of years of loneliness, complete isolation, misery, based on depression and all of these things that I deal with. I'd been completely isolated. And over the course of a year's time, God put me down in community. He surrounded me with friends, I mean, real friends, like I'd never had before. people who knew my heart and who understood me. And I just remember just weeping this time last year and just crying and saying, God, you did this. You did this for me. I couldn't have done this. I tried. But you did this, God. And I stopped and I remembered and I just praised him for that. And at that time, I had no way of knowing that over the next 8 months, two of those dearest friends would move. And I didn't know how lonely I would get and how sad and how I would feel abandoned and left behind. And just these feelings of, well, here we go again. I didn't know that all of that was coming. But because I remembered what God had done, even when it hurt so bad, I was able to say, God, you will do it again. You will do it again. And he has. He has. See, God wants to show us where he's faithfully been in the past so that we can march forward with complete confidence that whatever is up there, God will be there too. He wants to remind us that he's done it every time. Why would he stop now? Whatever is up there, he's there. He stood on the front side of every obstacle we've ever faced. He's gone before us through it, and he's waited on the other side ready to fulfill his promises to us. He's promised to never leave us, to be with us in everything, to use everything ultimately for our good, to redeem everything that's broken, to bring life where there's only been despair, to mend places where it seems there's no hope, to walk with you in everything, to pull you up when you cannot get up, to be your light in a world that seems determined to destroy you. He has promised to carry you, to walk with you, to make everything redeemable in his name. He has promised to build a home for you, and he has promised to come back for you and take you there. So in light of all those promises, what do we do today, staring across the river into God's promises? How do we react on New Year's Eve, going into a new year, knowing what we know now? God has one thing for us to do, and it's just to stop before we go. Just stop. Because he wants us to look back before we can look ahead. He wants us to remember before we anticipate. He wants us to tell the old stories before we start creating new ones. He wants us to remember what he's already done. The battles he's already won, the wounds he's already healed, the shame that he has already covered, broken places that he has already mended, lives he has already restored. He wants you to remember the times that you tried to hide and he came and found you, the times you could not get up and he pulled you out of the darkness. He wants you to remember that when you could not go on, he was your strength. And he wants you to remember all the dead places in your life that you have seen spring forth with life. He wants you to remember, because when you remember, when you look back on his faithfulness, then you can have even greater expectations for your future. You can move forward without fear, without worry, and without disappointment, because he was faithful then. He'll be faithful again. He'll do it again. Let's pray together.